I'm like, what is that? Yeah, it's good, actually. The rent is bad. Good thing, bad, bad, bad.
I need to watch the people, I need to, I'm really to.
Is there a front?
Okay, thanks for coming. Do people have copies of the notes? Yes? Good. This time we're doing, actually going to talk about SQL, SQL, which is to some extent the culmination of all this build-up of different kinds of presentation of data and recording it. So I'll roughly go over the landscape so far and then see where this fits in. And to some extent, having set it all up with interrelational, relational model, relational algebra, and tuple relational calculus, actually this bit is easy. This is just the making concrete, this is the real world implementation of all of the things we've seen before. So the general setup is that we have data out there that for whatever reason we believe to be really tightly structured so we can do things with it. And you start off by drawing some kind of diagram that captures how these things are related. So there are entities and there are relations between them. The entities have some kind of properties, some attributes, maybe the relations do too. And then there are other additional constraints on participation or key constraints, this kind of thing. So we have a loose expression of it, and then we start to make that more precise. So this is enough to discuss with other people the data plan and to see if it's likely to address the things that they were thinking of. It then becomes a bit more concrete and formal with the introduction of tables, which can capture both the properties of an entity and a relation. So an entity might be students, exams, whatever. You can have several of these. And some tables will really represent relations between two different kinds of entity. So there'll be key constraints that say anything in this field must appear over here, anything in this field must be referred there, and so on in whatever kind of connections you have. And again, you can express properties, you can say these must together form a composite key, that must form a key, certain things must be unique, and so forth. So you have a representation in the relational model. And then there's the question of asking queries over this. We might have captured all the data we want, but can we get it out again? At some point, the last lecture is going to rip it. So we write languages for describing the queries we want to make, or the manipulations we want to make upon the table. And the relational algebra, with projections and selection, renaming, and cross-product, intersection, union, and ultimately the join operation, is an algebra for manipulating these tables, from building larger tables from smaller ones, from slicing out pieces of tables, and for getting some kind of answer that captures the information we wanted to extract from the table. Typically, what happens is you build up the table by breaking apart the data into smaller pieces with the links between them, and then use these operations as a one-off to pull together the information you actually wanted. And these are directly rather large and heavy to implement, but they do give you a language for writing down and comparing implementations and saying that in order to perform these operations, the most efficient way to do it is actually order them like this, or ship out a certain computation to another machine and then process the answers after they come back. But it's somewhat hard to deal with or to express yourself in. And so we have the tuple relational calculus, which said we want all the records in here, all record S in some relation, such that for all T, something implies something. And so we have a logical statement that says, I want all the students who are on this course and not taking that course who qualified last year for this kind of thing. And you write that as an expression in this logical system, in the predicate calculus, which you then somehow, it says nothing about how it will be implemented. You can't assess the efficiency of an implementation at all just on that. But it can be translated into something in the relational algebra, which then can be assessed for, is this going to be feasible to execute? Do I need to rearrange it? Should I not even try because it's going to take too long to do? So we have this modeling hierarchy where we start with a vague model and get something more concrete. And we have a query hierarchy where we'd like a language a bit like this calculus to say what we want, a declarative one, and then have a way to automatically machine translate it into something procedural that will then go calculate it for us. And SQL is the kind of usable version of this sort of level of calculus. So if people want to extend SQL or put in new features, they can either hack away at the implementation and hope that it works. That's one route. And another route is to look at something more mathematical like the tuple relational calculus and say, if I added this certain operation, would it be well-defined? Would it be meaningful? Would it be consistent? Could we translate it into the algebra? And you can investigate those kind of properties before you even start coding to say, is this idea I have for an additional database operation even possible to do? And that's the role of these kind of languages. And SQL is the day-to-day actual writing a query over an existing relational database scheme. So I'll talk about SQL, give some examples of SQL. The tutorials next week and the week after consist of actually writing SQL, and at some point you'll fire up a database on the lab machines to try constructing one and writing queries over it. Again, fairly small examples, but you need to have some practice at it. SQL, structured query language, originally called SQL, but then it turned out that a large UK military operation already had a trademark on it, so they couldn't call it that. So it became SQL, which you could sort of pronounce SQL. It was originally developed by IBM, by a couple of people, as a front end to an existing database, and it caught on extremely rapidly for various historical reasons, but also because it was usable and readable. And it is currently easily the most widely used commercial relational database language. It has moved away from being a particular company's proprietary language tied to a particular product. It's used, so most large relational databases will provide an SQL interface, even if they do completely different things around the back. Even databases which are so-called NoSQL databases that take completely different approaches to data storage and management, there are things called column stores, or for particular applications you might want a different sort of slightly less structured data, they may provide an SQL front end because it is the universal language of database queries. It's not single company's language anymore. It's been adopted as an international standard and goes through a periodic revision process, last one in 2008. There'll be another one along soon. And the standards mean that for at least some subset of the language, queries are kind of portable. And query programmers are also portable. You can take somebody who's worked on SQL with one database and employ them to work on SQL on another database, and after a while they'll settle down and they won't complain too much. And this is really, really useful. So when it says most widely used, so it's most widely used by people writing SQL code, it's also most widely used by machines writing SQL code. And except to the first approximation, all SQL code is written by machines. Any that you happen to write as humans is really just a drop in the ocean. Most of it is written by machines in order to ask queries of other machines. So if you go to Amazon and you ask for a query about a book, or you go and try and look at railway times, or try and book an airline ticket. So you put in your journey times or your constraints into an airline booking system, and then it comes back with a table of possible flights and their prices and times and dates. And around the back, there will be a database, and what will happen is that the web front end will take your parameters and turn that into an SQL query. So something written in the language that we're going to look at. It'll feed it as ASCII, as completely readable text, to a back end, which will then compile it, decide how to optimally execute it, run it, and then return the answers back again. So between the front and the back, there is this textual, readable interface that is the SQL language. And this is true of a surprising number of programming languages, is that actually, although they started off being written by people to control the machines, mostly they're now written by other machines to control the machines. And all the reasons for having a good common language still apply when it's two machines talking to one another. So we've seen a bit of SQL already. We've seen the data definition language as a way to write down, I want this table, I want a particular relational table with certain key constraints and so forth. And in this lecture we'll talk about the data manipulation language, which allows you to add elements to rows or move them around or change tables. In fact, the one that's by far most widely used is the querying language. And if you come across a database, then you will almost always use the querying language first. But in order to get off the ground, to give a lecture on it and so on, we have to address the definition language and how to set up tables and how to add elements to tables and how to manipulate them, which in fact you hardly ever do. Most of the time you query an existing database. But the data manipulation language allows you to insert, delete, modify rows, and then crucially let you query it. SQL is big and it's complicated and it's changing and it depends on the product you're using. So in this lecture and in this course actually, you'll see only what is essentially the very, very basic kernel of SQL. It has all kinds of additional features pasted in, more and more of which gradually become part of the core language and can be reliably transferred between different products. So we'll see enough to write basic queries and to write queries that match the things we looked at in relational algebra. When you actually look at real queries in real database systems, you'll see all sorts of other keywords and hints. And sometimes that's just a clue to the database engine as to how you want it executed or how you think it might be best executed. Sometimes it is genuinely extending the power of the system. But more often than not, it's just some kind of idiom or shorthand saying, I want to do it in this way, and it's completely standard, so it's built into the language. So you'll see kind of the kernel of SQL with which you can do almost everything. But in practice, in any actual use, you'll have to learn a whole bunch of new keywords and properties. And again, that's typical of many things in computer science and programming. There's a core that you need to know. Once you know that, it's relatively easy to add all the other things on. But if you just go straight to the full system, it looks pretty intimidating because it's got like 55 keywords and a whole thick manual. Typically, that's not necessary to know all of that. There's a kernel that will work for you. And that's what we'll attempt to teach this time. If you do find databases particularly interesting, or this is something you want to pursue, then there's much more on SQL in our honours database systems, and then there's an advanced databases course in the fourth year as well, which look at lots of these extensions and other angles on SQL. So this is the kind of thing SQL looks like. This is to insert some data into an existing table. We saw the word commands to create a table, in this case students with matriculation number, name, age and email, and the underscore matriculation number means that that's going to be the primary key. We assume that every student has exactly one, has a matriculation number, and that's unique to the student. No. You add data to the table like this, you write a statement, insert into students the following values. And you don't have to, so here we've got, we've listed the fields that those values should go into. And that's not absolutely necessary because students' table does contain those fields in that order, so the system could probably match it up. But it's a lot more robust to put include them in the details. So say, add a student whose matriculation number is this, who's called Bob, 19, and has this email address. Actually, this is not a real student, I checked. And again, this is something that's how it's added. But most of the time when using a database system, you wouldn't see that. You'd see some front end that said, add a single item or upload a whole table of items. And you'd do that, and it would appear in the table. And what's happening around the back is that even the most basic front end is turning your action into exactly that program as text, and then passing it to a back end. And this seems somehow surprising. You'd think an integrated Caddly front end would have some deeper tendrils into the database system. But in fact, there's a real separation of concerns. You have databases which work with these kind of queries and graphic Caddly front ends that generate things like this. This is a universal principle across a lot of computing systems. It's the same with the web. Web pages have a textual language, HTML, which is perfectly readable and is still used between machines. Phones typically have two pieces of circuitry for the clever smartphone piece and the wireless connecting to the telephone network chip, which works at radio frequencies and does interesting electronic things. And even today, the smartest of smartphones, those two will communicate by a wire-level protocol that looks a lot like this, that dates back to about the 70s, of what you used to control modems with, that says, okay, followed by three dots will mean, please get ready to accept a signal. And then I want to send the following message. And so you'll have two processors or two pieces of circuitry inside the phone talking to each other through an interface that's completely textually readable. It's surprising kind of fossil that you see. And that's also true of SQL. So even if you never see SQL, it's really useful to know that it's there because it will determine what systems people can build and how you can interact with the front end. If you're aware that really the system is having to turn into one of these, then you can understand what the limitations and what the potentials are for that interface. So we've been able to add elements. We can delete entries. In this case, we want to delete several entries, so we have to say which entries we're going to delete. So we say delete from this table students. And students S means this table students, which we're going to call S for the moment. And the reason we need to give it a name is because we're about to say something about it, which is delete from students where S.name, so where the name field of a record is Bob. So delete all the students called Bob from the database. So if we wanted to delete a single entry, we'd have to say delete from students where, and then give sufficient information to pick a single row in the database. And the obvious thing to do would be to use a primary key, so we could do that. So that will delete all the students whose name is Bob. Yep.
Sorry, can we just write from students without S, as in where students dot name?
Yes, you could do that. The question is, can we just lift out the S bit and say from students where students dot name equals Bob? Yes, that will be absolutely fine. The only reason is that usually the where is going to be more complex than this, and you want to refer to it several times. But yes, absolutely. You may notice that there's a disambiguation here. You could have the name field appearing in multiple tables, but this would identify which one you wanted. In some circumstances, you can drop various of these things, and the system will infer it. Updating data, this says change a record that's already there. Again, we have to say which record, and in this case, we're giving a key field identification, the matriculation number. Say change the student record that can be picked out by this matriculation number, and change it to Bobby. Yes, at the back.
When you say delete, does it assume it will delete all other associated information with that field?
Yes. So the question is.
Assume.
Yes, it's R. So the question is, what does this delete? And that deletes the whole entry in the table. There is a further thing called a cascade, which is if other tables then refer to that, if we've got a constraint like this, a key constraint that says, for example, we have the students table, we also have a table about takes that says which two students take which courses, then what if, and there's a key constraint that says we're only allowed to say it, we only want to record this student takes that course, if the student is really a student. And if you then delete that student record, you've got a record in the takes table, which is now meaningless. It refers to a student who doesn't exist. The same would happen if you deleted a course. And when you set up the table, it's possible to specify what should happen. So, I mean, the sensible things could be raise an error, don't let this happen. If the student is referred to somewhere else, warn the user. That's one possibility. Another one we would say, delete anything that refers to this, and then anything that refers to that, go on deleting and so on. So that's called cascade. And it's the same would apply, or the other possibility would be to say, well, just make it null. Just say, give up, that student doesn't exist, we'll put a null entry in. And that might or might not be acceptable. So if you have a student DOS entry, for example, and the director of study leaves, you probably don't want to delete the student. It will be reasonable to note that the student now has no DOS, and that might raise a flag or a trigger somewhere, but you want to record that information. Whereas the student taking an exam, if the student disappears, then you're not interested in the fact that there's no student taking this exam. You can just drop the data altogether. So there is in fact. So this appeared in the tutorial exercise, but wasn't sufficiently trialled in the lectures. Some of the tutors may have talked about this. In a data declaration, who actually got to this exercise in the tutorials? Okay, so some people have seen this. In a declaration, you can say, you might have a foreign key statement that's, matriculation number, say. So matriculation number might reference a student's table. So we'd have, this is maybe in some takes relation that says, this student is taking this course. Or we might have, say, the matriculation number is a reference to the student table. What happens if that student is deleted from the table? And you'd say, on delete cascade, which would say, if the student's entry is deleted, then we delete this entry in the table. Other thing you could do would be things like on delete set null, make it null. And there are various refinements of that. You might also say, what happens if the student entry is modified, if the student's name is changed? Well, in that case, do nothing. But in some cases, you might want to change things and cascade just a modification down the reference tree. It's called the cascade because this is one change, but that may then cause further changes if this entry is deleted as well. And you can have a whole chain of these things happening. That's a very simple instance of what are called triggers in SQL, where you make a change to a database, and that immediately causes some other code to execute. Because you have these consistency requirements on a database, we set the tables up with these key constraints and participation constraints and so on, saying we want the data to be to have an integrity as a whole, where certain things are maintained at all times. And then the database system will attempt to help you do that. And sometimes you can do this through writing triggers, saying when a certain situation arises, don't stand for it, immediately change the database somewhere else. And you can build that into the logic of the database. There may also be triggers around the back to do with efficiency, towards generating new indexes or re-indexing certain parts of the data. If the table grows significantly in size, you might want to reconsider how you index it or re-index it against some more fields. Or if people make particular queries a lot, then you might want to add new indices to the database. All of these things can be handled by triggers. Right. So we've had creating tables, adding data, removing data, changing data. Actually, as I said, those don't happen very often. What really happens a lot is selection. And the basic form of a select query is select some fields from some tables where some things are true. And that actually can wrap up all of the projection, selection, renaming, and join or cross-product operations that we can think of. It's a compact way to represent the most common kind of query, which is take some tables, pick out some rows, satisfying some properties. And actually, not all queries can be done that. Sometimes you have to go through multiple stages. But an awful lot of what you want to do in a database can be wrapped up in that form of select query. So the select clause says which columns, which fields you want to get out of the answer. The from, so actually it's a projection, not a selection, sorry about that. The from clause says which tables we're interested in, and by default that just means take the cross product of all the tables, match up all of the rows and all of the tables with all of the rows and all of the other tables. And that's building, at least hypothetically, some enormous table. And then the where says which rows in that table are actually interesting. We're only interested in a relation between students and exams where the student is in fact taking the exam, that kind of thing. The where you don't absolutely need, because it might be that you really want all of the data in the table, but you certainly need a select and you need a from. So, somewhere we have a table. Do we have? Okay, we'll try with that. So this is some tables. So there's a table of students, a table of courses, and information about which students take to which course. And owing to the size of the slide, as you'll see, we have very few students, even fewer courses, and very few students take any of the courses at all. This is a particularly laid-back university. That's necessary to have it appear. But remember, the point about doing this in a database system at all is that typical database systems, you really have dozens of tables, usually, not just two or three. You have some dozens of tables. They'll have not four or five columns, but tens or hundreds of columns even, certainly dozens. And you'll have not just five or six rows, but you'll have hundreds, thousands, or even millions of rows. So you'll have some very large tables, which means that your first intuition about how to do the computation is probably wrong. You need to find ways to work over this data that is better than the thing you first think of, because the thing you first think of will run into trouble as soon as you try to do anything complicated. And so we have to stand back, and we can imagine how you do it on this sort of table, but put off the actual implementation to a separate problem, which is interesting and has in many ways been solved, but is kind of different from specifying what you want, the separation between what you want to do and how you're going to do it. So in this case, we have a query that says, select all students at least 19 years old. We saw this previously expressed in relational algebra and in tuple relational calculus. This is just its expression in ASCII, so you can type it. Select star, that means select all the information, all the fields from the students table. We're going to call the students table S, this query, where s.age is greater than 18. So that's, in fact, just a simple selection and operation. And it returns all the rows in the students table which satisfy that condition, which will be the last two, Helen and Peter. You can also be really precise about the fields and say we're interested in these fields. We're interested in the matriculation number, the name, the age, and the email, which is in fact all of the fields, from students S, where S age greater than 18. And here it's worth naming this table S because we use it five times, and it would be tedious to write out multiple times. The first form, yes, this thing about interactive querying. Typically, I'll describe queries in a form that you might type and that will then give the answer back again. And if you're doing interactive exploration of a database to see what the data is like, to see what kind of queries work, then that's appropriate to use star and say, give me all the fields. If you're trying to build some maintainable automated system, if you're writing the front end that will issue these queries to a machine, then use the more precise second form, because that's then robust. If the table acquires more fields, then that's okay, your query will still work. If the table loses a field, then you'll get early notification that you don't have the information because the query will fail before it's even started. Whereas with the star, it will appear to be kind of working, but you'll miss some information. Or it will appear to be working, but there's extra information coming in, and your later processing may fail. So typically, SQL comes in two forms. There's a form which is kind of for casual use of you trying things out, and then there's a more precise, sometimes a bit lengthier form that is what you should consider doing if you're automatically generating it. Yeah.
If we drop, for example, s.email, will that table will be only with three columns?
So the question is, what happens if you leave out s.email? Yes, that will correspond to a projection. You get just three columns. You get matriculation number, name, age. So you get a narrower table. This is in fact exactly what you're asking. This query returns a table with a row for every student, but with fewer fields. This last one, select distinct. So you can always put it distinct. So if we stop bringing back all of the rows in the table, then we might find that we have duplicates. we'd be getting, so in this case it doesn't happen, but supposing we had two students with the same name and the same age, which is entirely possible, and they only differed in matriculation number and email address, but we were only picking out the name and the age, then the initial query would give you back two entries, and the select distinct would give you back just one. In this case, it's not particularly sensible, but if, say, you wanted to know which courses do those students take, then you might initially you might get back a list of informatics one repeated 20 times, and actually you just want a distinct entries. No, we get more on that later. Okay, so we've got this general from this select that where the other, and this is the syntactic details of it. The from is going to be a list of tables, all the tables. So previously we've seen just a single table. In fact, you can mention multiple tables, and that will then cause a join to happen, where you'll build a big product and then pick out just some entries. The select list is a list of expressions involving column names, and so that'll be the kind of logical query. The select will say which things we want out, and the where will be a logical query, Boolean combination and or not of various computations. Is this field greater than that? Is this field equal to that other field, and so forth? And then distinct is, once you've got all the rows and you've chopped out the rest of the columns you need, if there are duplicates, do you throw them away or not? And that depends whether or not you use the distinct keyword. So the reasons you might not use the distinct is if you actually want to count the number of rows. You might want to say, well, how many students are there only taking a particular course? And then you don't want to remove the distinction. So what a query means is a little difficult to express, because as I've kind of bang on about, this is not the execution model. But you want some kind of idea of saying, well, how can I think about what the answer is going to be like? So there is this idea of conceptual evaluation strategy that says, well, this is one way you could work it out. It's in no way practical to actually do it in reality on anything larger than this kind of table. But it will reassure you that it's doing the thing you wanted to do. So calling it conceptual evaluation is supposed to say, just think about it. It's not really how it's going to be implemented. So the conceptual evaluation strategy for a straightforward SQL query is take the cross product of all the tables in the from list. So take every row from every table that's been mentioned and mash them all together. So you will get an enormous table with many columns and very, very, very many rows. Then apply the qualification test, the where clause, and see which rows have the property that you're looking for. And then delete all of the others. So you pick out just some rows. You now have a few rows, but lots and lots of columns. And then only pick out the columns that are mentioned in the selection to do a final projection. And then, if distinct is specified, remove all of the duplicates. So you have this kind of three-stage process of build a big product, build a big cross product, pick out some rows, pick out some columns. Now, real-world database management system does not work like that. It will be completely infeasible to do so. What they do is do something that is going to give the same result as this, but will finish before the universe grows cold. And in practice, this is done by translating to an algebra that looks really complicated and then applying all kinds of estimates, heuristics, to work out how long they think it's going to take, and then trying a different combination to see if they think it'll work better. And that's based on all kinds of information about the size of the databases, what you have indices for, when primary keys are involved, because where a primary key is involved, you can do it faster, where a secondary key is involved, something else that could be used as the key but isn't. So-called selectivity, which is how often does something occur. So in a table of names, for example, selectivity, you might have information about how often the same name reappears, and that can guide how query, what's the efficient way to represent a query. And this query optimization is a huge field, because online databases are already well past the stage where an algorithm that you would write down by hand will work. They only function because we have smarter algorithms. And some of them are pushing the limit of what the smarter algorithms can do. So it is worth trying to think of even more smart ways to use query optimization. You can try things out on a small piece of the database if it runs quickly, used on a big one and so on. That's a big area of research, is to try and say, how can I take this query that's quite sensible, that somebody asked, on this database that is sensible but turns out to be extremely large, because it's every purchase anybody ever made on Amazon, say, and get a reasonable answer out of it. And a reasonable answer in a reasonable time. So that's really where all the action is in databases. There's a thing about multi-steps. So this is maths, really, but it happens to be relevant here. SQL keeps duplicate rows and tables. lots of the math behind relational database systems says databases, rows are just sets. The ordering doesn't matter. You don't have duplicates. We just want to know if a row is there or not. SQL is actually a bit sensitive to the order of the fields, the order of the rows, and particularly it keeps duplicates. So actually, SQL model is not a set of rows, but a multi-set. So a multi-set is it's also called a bag. It's a set where there are multiplicities. So you have some elements. The order of the elements doesn't matter. So here the sets 2, 3, 3, 5, and 3, 2, 5, 3, they're the same multi-set, but they're different from the set 2, 3, 5, because the number of times 3 occurs in it. So up there, they're the same. The middle row, we have four different multi-sets. So 2, 3, 5, and 2, 3, 3, 5, those are different multi-sets because 3 occurs one in one and twice in the other. So they're not like normal sets. You count multiplicities, but you don't count the ordering. So sometimes people will use different symbols to represent these. Unfortunately, there's no agreement on what the different symbols should be. So you'll see things like braces with a bar on to mean this is a multiset, this is a bag. You'll sometimes see that notation looks a bit like this, which is quite cute because if you have, that is a bag. If you have the empty one, then it looks like an empty bag. So some kind of notation is sometimes in there to hint on it. There is, so there's a small proposal which got nowhere at all to say that, so you have lists which are where order matters and multiplicity matters. You have sets where order doesn't matter and multiplicity doesn't matter. You have multi-sets or bags where order doesn't matter but multiplicity does matter. And there's a Dijkstra, a famous but somewhat eccentric computer scientist of note, insisted that actually multi-sets were the basic notion. A bag was the basic notion of collection of things. Sets, the idea that the multiplicity didn't count, was an abstraction laid over it by mathematicians. So really what you had were the world was made of bags, which is these things, and then if you really insisted on having just one element in it, then what you had was a unibag. So it wasn't sets and multi-sets, it was bags and unibags. This got no traction whatsoever. But if you ever see a unibag, you'll know what it is. But multi-sets do indeed turn up in computer science perhaps more often than sets do. So in this case, SQL, the rows are multi-sets, bags. Ah, oh, right, while I'm diverting. So we got up to Kappa, lambda. So you will all recognize lambda from a Haskell course last semester, yes? It's a kind of an L. Capital lambda is an upside down V, and lambda represents abstraction, usually. Occasionally used as a abbreviation for things that begin with L, but not much. Mu, capital one looks like an M. Mu used for micron, micro, anything 10 to the minus 6, also mean, average. So mu used to represent m's, actually appears in ASCII because you can use it as the micro prefix. Lambda mu mu. Mu is the n in Greek and will be used to represent things that begin with n. Occasionally as a sort of spare mu. If you're going to use mu, but it's already used for something else, you use mu instead. It's written as a V, but to avoid confusing it with V's, you usually find it's written in some sort of slightly swirly roundabout V that suggests something different is going on. There's also, it'll get used, this is kind of a convenient pun, but when something is new, you will find people use mu as the abbreviation for it, and that's sort of kind of cute, if confusing. Xi. This is a silly letter. This is the X, and it goes like this. That. So that's Xi. The one is three lines, you can kind of jazz it up a bit with Cerise if you like. And it's really interesting because it's not simply connected. You can't get this in a fridge magnet. Well, you can, but it has been failed. It's bad. It's unique. The small psi, this is the one that's just a squiggle. Right? If you write just squiggle, then people will guess that it's psi. Whereas zeta, which is the z, looks like this and is different. Psi doesn't turn up that much. You see this on taxis in Greece. But using this as a symbol is just a recipe for disaster because you just think you've scribbled out everything in your notes. And then there's also omicron, which is a small o, which looks far too like the Latin o to be much use in representation, though occasionally you will see it. So, psi, most important letter you learned today. So these are the sample tables. So now we've got some queries over those tables. Find all the students who are taking informatics 1. So this is the first time we're getting a join between two tables. We're not just picking out parts of a single table, we're getting some information that requires combining two tables together. So select the student name. So we want the names only of the students who are taking informatics 1. That means we're interested in the student table, courses table, and the tapes table. And we're going to call those S, T, and C for this purpose. So from students, tapes, and courses, we want to pick out all the entries where the student's matriculation number is the matriculation number of the person in the take relation, and the take code matches the course code, and the course's name is Informatics 1. So the conceptual evaluation strategy says build an enormous cross product. Build a table with 16 rows and 10 columns. So the 10 columns are the student's matriculation number, name, age, email address, course code, name of the course, year of the course, matriculation number of a student, course code again, and mark. So there's lots and lots of duplication there. And there's lots of things we're not interested in at the end. We don't care what the student's email address is because we're only interested in their name. So you build this massive table that in principle holds all the information there is. And then, so yes, mark the columns. The rows are a meaningless combination, by and large. It's every possible student row with every possible takes row and every possible courses row. So it'll have information that says, this is a student named John. Here's some information that says one student takes a course, but that student is not John. And here's some information about a course, and that student is not the course that's been taken. But we then delete that because we pick out only the rows that where the matriculation number of the student and the one taking the course are the same, and where the code of the course and the course called Informatics 1 are the same. So we then only pick out the rows that are relevant, rows that actually talk about a student who is taking a course, and the course is called Informatics 1. So this takes you down to just one row, because in fact there's only one student taking that course. But we still have far too many columns, because we have the trace of all the information we were using to make this decision, or might have used. So the next stage says, eliminate all the columns except name. So we get down to just a table with one row and one column called Mary. We're then not applying the distinct specifier, so we don't need to do that. And even if we were, it wouldn't make any difference. But this is the kind of query where distinct could make a difference. And actually, this query is stupid for not doing distinct, because it is inconceivable, well, to me. I'm unable to think of a situation in which you would need to know, for all the students taking a particular course, by name, and you wish to eliminate duplicates where people happen to have the same name. I don't know, maybe you're collecting birthday cards for them, so you need to know their date of birth and say, happy birthday, Bob. But you don't need two cards for Bob's. This is not a sensible query. It should be select distinct name for this one. Another query. So this is going the other way around. Find all the courses taken by someone called Mary. That's also slightly spurious. But it's a reasonable query if you have a person and you only know their name to say what courses are involved in here. They'll probably want to get their matriculation number. So this says select the name of the course from, and again we want to know about students taking courses, all three tables, where the student name matches up with the one we have the takes information for, and the course code is the course code, and the student's name is Mary. The conceptual evaluation for this will be the same. Build an immense table that has all the information. Select only the rows that talk about Mary's courses, where, and then there will only be one in this case, and then pick out just the column that says what the name of that course is. And again, actual execution of this will not involve constructing that massive table. It will involve running around this database saying, well, what is the course code for Informatics 1? Where does that appear in the takes table? That gives me a list of matriculation numbers. Let's go and look at the student table and pick out the ones with that matriculation number. Any reasonable database engine will actually do the most efficient thing on this because it's a reasonably simple problem and we have complete information about what's connected to what in the database. So we can write it in this general form and we can check that it does capture the thing we want, but the implementation will almost certainly be the most efficient one you can think of in this kind of query. If we had truly enormous tables of students and courses, some other route might be more appropriate. Slightly more complex, all students taking Informatics 1 or Maths 1. So all students taking one course or another course. So this says build the table of all students taking courses and pick out ones where the name and code match up, matriculation number and code match up, and then we're interested in courses where the course name is Informatics 1 or Mathematics 1. This is another way to write the same query. Which says, and here we've got a union. So SQL still has these set operations in there. Says select all the students taking Informatics 1 and all the students taking Mathematics 1 and then take the union of those two sets. So the first one is going to be a list of names, second one is going to be a list of names. The union means take all the names that appear in either list. Don't count them twice if they appear twice in each list. We could also write that. Yeah, so we can write that either by putting it in the selection component, says I'm interested in the taking a course that's either Informatics 1 or Mathematics 1, or select all the Informatics 1 students and then the Mathematics 1 students. Quite possible on this kind of query that actually the back end would implement them both the same way. The only question is, how did you think of this query? And you could write it either way. It might be that you then want to extend it to some broader thing or specialize it in some way. Students taking both Informatics 1 and Mathematics 1. This is a bit tricky because now we want to look at the takes table and we want to use it twice. We've gone to pick a student and see a student who takes Informatics 1 and a student who takes Mathematics 1. So this says select from, and now we have two copies of the takes table and the courses table. So we can have a table appearing more than once in the from clause, and there we definitely need to give it a shorthand name to say which one we're talking about. So we're selecting students, takes courses again, where we've got takes 1 means takes Informatics 1, takes 2 takes Mathematics 1, and again we have to incorporate the courses table to find out to relate the course code to the course name, because the query only says the course name. So that's quite hard to do, and is actually going to be fairly inefficient. The other way is to use an intersection to say all students taking course 1, and then all students taking course 2. So those are, I don't know, how many sample queries we got? That's because I'm using a different machine.
I have a question about this intersect.
Mm-hmm.
Must we use different variables like S1 and S2? Don't just write everywhere S, like people think about S only in the different
part? No, they're purely local to the query. So you could use the same one, it's only because I was relating it to decomposing this one. You could give them in. And they don't have to begin with X, right? It's just always kind of convenient to do so. Informatics 1 but not Mathematics 1, use an except. So that's a set difference operation. Find pairs of matriculation numbers so the one student in the pair gets a higher mark than a second student. And it's the same as we have, again, two copies of the students table, two copies of the takes table, because we want to pick out different bits of information. So in principle, this is building an even bigger table. But actually, we just select out ones where the student takes Informatics 1, and the second student takes Informatics 1, and the course, the mark of the first student is greater than the mark of the second student. And again, the conceptual evaluation goes via some enormous tables, of which we pick a few rows. Actual evaluation will be much more efficient, and we'll just trawl through them. So in this case, it probably will have to go twice through the list of students in order to get all the comparison marks. Okay, and you can also, so we've just picked out rows. Once you've got them, you can then do things with them. You can count how many rows there are. You can take averages of data. You can look at maximum, minimum. So example is find how many students are taking a course. So essentially you get the list of students, and then you count it. Find the average mark, get the list of marks, take the average. And I have one example, which is, remember this Sky server of database? So those are queries over a really, really small database. This is a query over a much, much larger database. But the queries look just the same. This is one of the advantages of SQL. Once you've got it, you can apply it to all kinds of databases at all sizes. And that works just as well for you as it does for some graphical front end that is feeding these queries in. So this is a query over the star database that says, find some stars near a spot in the sky, select top 10. This is like counter average. This is one of the things to pick out just a few. Select object ID, the run on which it was photographed, the fields, right ascension and declination, the position in the sky, from, now we have one table of photo tag. This means objects of which